All right, we're going to be in chapter 5 tonight with Ecclesiastes. We're going to kind of slow things down. We've been trying to get two chapters in each night, and tonight we'll be doing just chapter 5, so you can maybe rest a little bit in that. So just by way of recap, we've moved along. We've talked about some maybe of the more popular passages in Ecclesiastes, dealing with a time or a season for everything, and talking about a lot of kind of repetitive, repetitive in some way as far as vanity of vanities. We see that quite a bit. We've gone through and Solomon has talked about different vanities. He initially talked about the things that there's vanity in wealth, vanity in wine, women, and song, and going through different things. And today we're going to kind of hone in on some things that might seem repetitive, but we'll get into it and develop it a little bit more. So we look at more vanity in the world. We're continuing this same section in our outline. Chapter 5 kind of is perched right here in the middle of it. We'll be looking at vanity in the world and worldly worship. Would you say that it is possible to have vanity in worship? Yes, right? It is possible to have vanity in worship. And what does chapter 5, verse 1 start off with? What does he say? Right, talking about how we walk. Guard your steps as you go to the house of God. Draw near to listen rather than to offer sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. What is a metaphor for walking? And that's used a lot in the Bible. What do we talk about when we talk about guarding our steps? Is he physically talking about making sure you do not stub your pinky toe when you're walking up to Jerusalem? Is that what they're... No, that's not what we're really dealing with. What are we dealing with when we're talking about guarding our steps? What's that? Our spiritual steps, right? Our spiritual things. So if we're going to talk about guarding our steps, somebody look at Psalm 119. It's interesting that Solomon's dad talked a little bit about this. Psalm 119, verses 101 to 102. I have restrained my feet from every evil way, that I may keep your word. I have not turned aside from your ordinances, for you yourself have taught me. What has he restrained his feet from doing? What's that? Evil, right? I've restrained my feet from evil. Do we have feet that are just demon-possessed, that just rush to evil? What's going on with our feet? What is the metaphor there? Life. He's talking about a certain path, even in this section of scripture. He's talking about a path. Can we get off the path, right? The idea there is there are temptations. There are things we see. How many of you have seen little children walk as toddlers and something sparkles and they just go, ah, like they just kind of walk towards that, right? They just kind of move over towards, can we do that spiritually? Something sparkles, something glitters, and our feet start to turn, right? We get this idea that we know something and our feet start to turn. And God's like, no, I told you where you need to walk. I've told you, I've guided. And that's what the Psalm 119 really talks about, that God's word has guided our footpaths. So if one way to keep myself from not to guard my feet is the key word in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 1 is what? What's the key word there? If I'm going to keep my path on the path that God wants, what's the key action verb or key word there that I need to be? Listen. My father told me that a lot. I swore I would never say it like him. And I have. But it's so true, right? Listen, right? Listen. Boy, listen to the words that are coming out of my mouth. This is what you need to do, right? So in the same way, God is saying, listen, guard your steps. Don't come up to me like you know something, right? Don't come up to me just doing whatever you want to and your worship be in vain. Look also in Proverbs chapter 4. Solomon has talked about this before. Proverbs chapter 4. Would somebody read that? Proverbs chapter 4, verse 26 and 27. Would somebody read that for us, please? All right, again, this concept of think on what you're doing. Ponder the footsteps that you're supposed to be taking. Don't go to the what or to the what? To the right or the left, right? Either one. Stay on the path that's before you. So this over again. So he's talking about our attitude towards God in this context. Our worship towards God, regarding reverence to God. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 22. Would somebody read that for us? Some of you guys have those apps. You can just flip right to it. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 22. Loud and proud. You're going to make me do it. 1 Samuel chapter 15. That's a very key passage in the history of Israel. We see that not only in the prophets over and over again, and even in the time of Christ, that they are focused so much on what? On going through the motions. I'm going to do these things. In Isaiah, God eventually says, I am tired of your feasts. I am tired of your offerings. They are bothersome to me. They make me physically ill, your feasts and your sacrifices and your offerings, because you have forgotten what? You've forgotten to obey me. You come to me with bloody hands. You come to me sinful. And so again, this concept that we need to make sure that when we approach God, that we don't just come in here with some flippant attitude about approaching God. We come in here to worship a holy God. We need to come here to listen and to see what God has to say, so that, in this context, he says, for they do not know that they are doing evil. Matthew chapter, Isaiah 1:11 talked about what we were talking about earlier. Matthew chapter 7, 21 through 23 talks about those who had come to God. Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, and in thy name done many works, and in thy name cast out demons, and in thy name, you know, went on many mission trips, and in thy name did so many VBSs. And he said what? Depart from me, workers of iniquity. I never knew you. It is possible for us to go through the motions and do these wonderful things and God not know who we are. Is that we need to kind of maybe take some stock in how we are approaching God and how we're making sure we're guarding our steps and doing the things that He wants to. And we'll talk more about some of this as we go through tonight. But another part of this chapter regarding prayer, regarding conversation with God. Do not be hasty in word, verse 2, or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. For God is where? In heaven, and you are on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. Right? For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of the fool through many words. Yes, sir. Yes, that would be part of it, and we'll see more of that in a moment. But yeah, let your words, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring something to the presence of God. And maybe we pray in such a way that we really don't know what we're asking. We really don't know, and we pray a prayer that in that moment, whatever this item is, it is the most important thing to us, and this has, God, this has to happen. This thing has to happen. And we're so focused on this thing. And when that thing doesn't happen and we're still alive and the earth has not imploded and there was no earth-shattering kaboom, God's like, that was not what needed to happen in that moment, right? But we are focused on those things. We need to pray, obviously, but pray in such a way that that we allow God to do what He's... Don't be hasty in saying the word. Don't... what does the King James or a New King James says? Bring up a matter. How does the version read? Do not be not rash. Don't say words that you don't know really what you're trying to say. And also, this concept of dream comes with much effort. In a lot of busyness, have you ever noticed that your sleep might be a lot more restless when you're busy and bothered about many things? Have you noticed that? It's like a pattern that repeats there. And so the dream comes through much effort and the voice of the fool through many words. So here's this idea of things that are kind of wasteful. Unrestful sleep is useless, right? You wake up and it's like, I'm as tired as I was when I went to bed, right? How many of you are there sometimes? Okay. And then the many words of a fool. We can all relate to somebody we know that's like that, right? Not ourselves, but somebody we know. Everybody has a friend like that. They're just a lot of words. Is not doesn't make a person wise. What's that? Where the vanity issue comes in with words? Yeah. What does Matthew chapter 6 say? Did I actually have this up here? I did. Let's look at some of these things. Look at 2 Chronicles and talking about prayer. 2 Chronicles. Second Chronicles, they've just had the dedication for the temple, of course, that Solomon was able to build. Thus Solomon finished the house of the Lord in the king's palace and successfully completed all that he had planned on doing in the house of the Lord and in his palace. Then the Lord appeared to Solomon at night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. If I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or if I command the locusts to devour the land, or if I send pestilence among my people, and my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, and I will forgive them their sin, and I will heal their land. What has to happen first here before they pray? You have to humble yourself. So when I pray to God, am I praying in humility, or am I praying, am I demanding something? For you are on earth, and God is in heaven, right? Who are you to ask this of God in this way? Isaiah talks about, in Isaiah chapter 45, verse 9, can the clay say to the potter, you did it wrong, basically, paraphrased the New Joshua version. Can the clay say to the potter, you did this wrong? No. Who are you to say that to God? When we talk about prayer, what's our, you know, there's many times we think of the Lord's Prayer, the Matthew chapter 7. What happens before that prayer? What information do we have about prayer before that prayer is actually said? What does Christ say? Beginning in verse 5. When you pray, make sure everybody sees you doing it, because that it matters more. And if you get a trophy for praying, that's even better. That's awesome. Okay. When you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the streets, corners, so that they may be seen by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you pray, do not use meaningless repetition like the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they'll be heard for their many words. And maybe you've heard examples of that, but it is not necessarily about the actual physical act. I mean, we need to pray to God, but the heart needs to be engaged in it. The heart needs to be humble, obedient, and ready to serve, and ready to for whatever answer comes our way, right? And that needs to be plugged in when we talk about prayer. Regarding vows, and this is not weddings, ladies and gentlemen. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, like the IRS, right? So what does he begin talking about here in this section of Scripture? What are we talking about vows? A promise, right? A promise. Deuteronomy chapter 23, let's look over there real quickly. Deuteronomy chapter 23. When you make a vow unto the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be a sin in you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be a sin in you. You shall be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised. And that's kind of echoed here in these words. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you would not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin. And do not say in the presence of the messenger, I think in some versions has angel, but it is the concept of messenger of God, that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? What are we looking at here? Again, he kind of goes into the, what are we looking at about vows? Is that possible to do today? Is that possible to do today? What's that? Yeah, in what way? How do we do vows today? What do we say to God? Yeah. Condition, like, God, if this just happens right here, then I will not eat Cheetos for like a year, right? And so, you know, just random things like that. We think that makes it more important if we do things like that. Are those kind of rash vows? Do we just make those kind of comments and just say those things, and then do we end up eating Cheetos later on? Probably, right? I mean, that's obviously just a stretch, but you understand the point, right? You understand what we're trying to get at. We say we're going to do these things, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to make this change, God, and then do we always follow through? We don't always follow through. Yes, sir? Yeah, sometimes those vows come in on the heels of some big mistakes, right? The kind of "Lord save me, I'm drowning" kind of moments, and we do, but we need to make sure that the words that we're saying we take seriously when we talk to God. Yes, exactly. We need to think about what we're saying to God and what we're praying to Him about. Look in James chapter 3, verse 5. James chapter 3, verse 5. Can our tongue get us in trouble? So also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. See how great a forest it set aflame by such a small fire. Can our tongue get us in trouble in our relationship with God? It can. What does he say here in talking about the messenger? He says, do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger or angel of God, oh, that was a mistake. Oops, I really didn't mean that vow. That wasn't really quite what I meant to say. What I had said, well, you know, it's we try to back up. And so that's what he's saying. Don't make that mistake. And so, again, in many dreams and in many words, there's emptiness or vanity. Just fear God. Do what you're going to do. Say what you're going to say. And fear God. So that was what he's trying to get at here in this section. So as we continue, we begin kind of this other section about wealth again, dealing with wealth. And wealth is going to be the rest of chapter 5 and into chapter 6, talking about money and kind of the use thereof. But riches can oppress, right? Verse 8, if you see oppression of the poor, in denial of justice or robbery of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. What are we talking about oppression? Haven't we talked about that before? Oppression? We talked about that in chapter 4, right? Grievous oppression. It would be better for them not to even be born. And so he talked about this, but we're talking more this now about oppression and dealing with money. Isaiah chapter 10. Would somebody turn over to Isaiah chapter 10 to read that for us? Isaiah 10, verses 1 through 3. Isaiah 10, 1 through 3. All right, so here again, Isaiah speaks a lot to the grievances that the people had in that time. There are things they were doing that were obviously wrong. And in many cases, we have this idea of the injustice that was done to the widows, to those who were needy. And so he talks about depriving justice, robbing the poor of their rights, not only just their money, plunder the orphans. And so God is always seen as the protectorate of the needy, the downtrodden. God is always seen. He taught his people from the very beginning, do not charge usury or taxation to your brethren or to those that dwell among you. Do not charge, you know, extra, not taxes, but percentage on what is borrowed. And there's just so many different laws he put in place to protect those that were needy. Even when they brought in the crops, if something fell out of the wagon, what were they supposed to do with it? Leave it, right? They had to round out the corners. They didn't glean all the way into the corners. There were certain things that they did to protect and take care of those that were needy. Christ said, the needy, the poor, you will always have with you. And God put things in place for them to be taken care of. He is the protectorate. Because in verse 3, what does he say? Now, what will you do in the day of punishment and in the day of devastation, which will come from afar? Basically saying, where are you going to hide from me when I come and visit upon you what you've been doing to those that are poor and needy? And so God is seen as that protectorate. And so he's saying what you're going to see, it's going to be common to see these kind of things happen. Have you ever seen this take place where, you know, the authority being abused from the top and kind of falls down? Everybody in authority today is crystal clean. Nobody abuses power anymore. But back then they used to more, right? Abuse power. Of course, we're being tongue-in-cheek there. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 17. We're going to compare two verses here concerning a king. Deuteronomy chapter 17. Is it interesting to you that before they even got into the promised land, before they even set up any sort of real roots in the land, they were already talking about when someday you ask for a king, this is what needs to happen. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, it talks about specifically what a king is supposed to look like, what they're supposed to do, what they're not supposed to do, and what are some things that are of note that they're not supposed to do. Deuteronomy chapter 17. We're not going to read this whole section, but he said, someday, verse 15, you're going to set a king over you. He's supposed to be, can it be from some random country? No, he's got to be your own countryman. He has to be 35 years or older. That was a joke, sorry. And what else? Verse 16, what can he not do? Yeah, he's not supposed to multiply what? Horses, because you can't have the horses of Penzance. You can't do that kind of stuff. No, why multiplying horses, what are we talking about? What are we talking about? Army, exactly right. We're talking about you can't have a bunch of Humvees, right? You can't have a bunch of Humvees and chariots because who are you supposed to trust in? God, all right? So you don't multiply for yourself these things. Horses, nor shall you cause people to return to Egypt and to multiply horses. What else in verse 17 are you not supposed to multiply? Why? Solomon, right? Okay. Did we see that take place with Solomon? Yes, we did. Solomon was actually, the king is supposed to write down and copy the law. Did you know that? The king is supposed to copy the law and have his own copy. Because you know what they didn't have back then? They did not have Xerox. It probably would have worked better. But anyway, so they didn't have these things to carry around with them, right? They didn't have little cell phones with apps in them that could have a copy of the law. People were supposed to stand and read and understand the law, but they didn't have their own personal copy in every house, right? That wasn't something they necessarily had. It was expensive, cost prohibitive. But the king was supposed to do what? In his own hand, copy the Torah. Do you think he learned something if he did that? Right? If you're reading it and you're copying it with your hand and you're hearing it, you might learn something. Did Solomon skip Deuteronomy chapter 17? Maybe he did. I don't know. He fell asleep when he was writing that day. But there are certain things and certain ways that kings are supposed to act. Now, when they are finally in the situation where they want to have a king, and Samuel's like, are you sure that this is what you want to do? Are you sure you want to have a king? Samuel reminds them of something. Look over in 1 Samuel chapter 8. What does Samuel remind him of, or remind the people of? What is he saying to them? It's going to be awesome when you get a king. We're going to be like dressed the same all the time. What is he saying about the king? Yes, he will abuse his power. This is what's going to happen. This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots. He's going to send your sons to war. Your daughters are going to be his servants. And so he talks about all these things that are going to take place when you have a king. Do these things take place? Yes, they do, right? Now, does that mean that a king is wrong? They shouldn't have had a king. That means they should not have ever had a king. They could have had a king and it had been okay, right? Because, like David, right? David was an awesome king. It could have gone well. I mean, they wouldn't have written Deuteronomy chapter 17 if having a king wasn't a possibility, right? They would have said, no kings ever. But it was a possibility for them to have a king and have a good king. But what happens with people, we tend to abuse power when it's given to us, right? Hashtag Barney Fife. Everybody's met one of those, okay? That happens. But is power in place, is that there for a reason? If you looked over in Romans chapter 13, is power in place for a reason? What does Romans chapter 13 say about power? About authority? It was established by God, even when we don't like it. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Does that mean that every authority and every decision that authority makes is sanctioned by God? No, it does not. That means that authority in what it's supposed to do is there and placed by God, but those authorities can make mistakes. They will make mistakes. Not can, but will make mistakes. But we are supposed to be in subject to those things. So rulers are there for a cause. Verse 3, for rulers are not a cause for fear, but for good behavior, but for evil. So if you do good and do what you're supposed to do, you shouldn't be afraid, right? If you stay within that, 5 mile an hour kind of comfort zone, you're good. But once you get outside of that, start feeling the blue lights, right? That's that you got to operate inside the parameters. You know what I'm talking about. Don't look at me like you don't do it too, okay? All right, so you know what I'm talking about. That's where we're supposed to operate. Now, will the government in certain situations be oppressive with taxes? And yes, even Solomon was such. But if a king is doing what they're supposed to do, then it cultivates the field, right? In verse 9, if the king is doing what they're supposed to and everything is acting the way it's supposed to, it is an advantage to the land. Verse 9 of, we're back in Ecclesiastes, sorry, I jumped. Chapter 5, verse 9, if the king is doing what they're supposed to be doing, that's an advantage to the people, and things will be rectified. Now we're getting more into that's Deuteronomy, we need to, yes. Hurry along quickly. So riches can oppress. Can riches always satisfy? As long as I get plenty of money, everything's going to be fine. Proverbs says no, right? Proverbs says no. Solomon even earlier said no. That's not going to happen. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Solomon can attest to that. Nor will he who loves abundance with his income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. Just after so close to April, it's appropriate that we said that. As money increases, those who consume them increase, right? Those things that increase. There's so many different ways that money, if you get more money, what happens to it? It just goes, right? It just finds its way out of your hands. So what is that advantage? He says just to look on and watch it leave. Proverbs chapter 11, verse 29. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. Is the love of money a good thing? Money in and of itself obviously is not, right? But the love of money can pierce us through with many troubles, right? So that's, we need to make sure that we keep all those things in perspective. And then Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5 as well, if you want to write those down. We don't have time to go through those tonight. All right, riches can be harmful. What happens with the sleep of a... What's the difference between the sleep of a working man and the sleep of a rich man in verse 12? What's that? The rich man, or the laboring man, sleeps a little bit easier, right, than the rich man. And this goes back to something that we've kind of covered quite a bit. And he goes back to this idea of all good things come from God and being content with the things that we have. And he goes back to this, and that's kind of an homage back to that same idea. And so there is a grievous, verse 13, there is a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun. When you read that, what are you thinking? Oh man, it's going to get really dicey now, right? It's going to be, what is he going to be talking about? Riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. That is not, we see that all the time. That doesn't seem like such a grievous thing, does it? Is it? Does that seem that grievous? Obviously, it can be. I mean, right? What is Luke chapter 12? When you have the parable of the rich man, that he had more and more gains, and he said, "Well, let me just build bigger barns, tear down my old barns, and build bigger barns, and I'll just put it all in there, and I can do whatever I want to do." Right? And what does God say? "That's a great idea. I'm glad you invested that." Right? No, he said, "Thou fool! This day I require your life of you." So. Again, there is that kind of concept with that. It can be harmful. Job chapter 1, verse 21. What does Job say about our life at the end of it? When those riches are lost through a bad investment, what happens at the end of our lives? Do we get to take pavement with us? How many of you have heard the pavement joke? That's right. That's right. You came naked into this world, and you will leave naked. How many of you have heard the pavement joke? Anybody? The pavement joke? Guy dies, wants to take gold with him, gets up to heaven, says, "Why'd you bring pavement?" Anybody? Nobody? Okay, so that was a dad joke. That's like a preacher / dad joke. So anyway. Was it a bumper sticker?
There was a different one. It said, "He who dies with the most toys still dies."
Yes. That's like, quote, Solomon, right? It's that kind of vanity of vanities. Everybody dies. Everybody goes to the same place. You're not going to get to keep it. When those riches are lost through a bad investment or through some other way, and he had fathered a son, and there's nothing to support him. We lose those things. We just watch them go. And so as he came naked from his mother's womb, so we'll return as he came. He will make nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. You're not taking anything with you, verse 15. Right? It's not going with you. So as you look at this section, so this also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? This goes back to what we've talked about earlier. If we're content and we work and we do our job and we have enough for what we need to do to live, then we can be content in that. But if I'm spinning my wheels trying to get more and more and more and more and more, extra, 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 am I ever going to be satisfied? I can always work just a little harder. I can always do a little more. There's hundreds of stories of people who got to the apex of their businesses, of wealth, and wish they had a simple life with a loving family that they no longer had. Right? There are tons of TED Talks about that kind of concept. And so we need to, it's been here the whole time. It is not a new thing that we would miss those things. And so we see those things. So verse 17, throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and hunger. And this is the person with a greedy heart. He's never satisfied. This is Ebenezer Scrooge. He's never satisfied. If you're content and you have this concept of I'm focused on what was pleasing to God and I can be content with where I am, if I'm in that place, then I'm never here. I'm never in this situation that in darkness and great vexation and anger because of loss of money, because it's for God, right? It's just stuff. God gave it to me, and I'll use it for His glory. That's a good place to be. And we'll talk, I guess, right now about that same kind of thing. We can use riches, can be enjoyed, and we'll close this chapter out. Is money wrong? Do we ever get in a situation where just having money is wrong? No, but it can be a danger, but we need to also make sure that it can be used for good. So here's what he said was a bad thing. In verse 18, here's what I've seen to be a good thing or a beautiful thing: to eat, to drink, and to enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Is it wrong to enjoy the blessings God's given us? No, it's not. And it's never wrong to, it's never, I guess, how should I say, it shouldn't feel guilty for enjoying what God has given us. Now, if we're using it to the exclusivity of our own pleasures and not to glorify God in any way, that might be something to give us pause. But in this case, if just using what God has given us, that is a blessing, that is a beautiful thing. And realizing, again, kind of going back to what he said earlier, all those things come from God. God has blessed us with these things. What does he say furthermore in verse 19? Furthermore what? Where do riches come from? Again, God. As for every man whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them. So it's not just a situation God's given to him and you've got to just kind of hoard them up, but to use them to receive from his reward, this is a gift of God. Again, going back to what we've seen earlier about where the source of these things. For he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps them occupied with the gladness of his heart. So it is not wrong to have riches. It is not wrong to be wealthy. It is wrong whenever that becomes our focus. It is wrong when that becomes what drives us. And it's wrong when we don't use those things to the glory of God. Yes, sir?
Material wealth will not transfer
your spiritual wealth. No. Yes. Yeah, did you hear that? There is this barrier where gold will not go into anything spiritual, right? I can't buy anything spiritual with gold. I can't use gaming analogies in here because it won't work necessarily. But it's that kind of idea that there are things that just don't transfer across that barrier. Where I was going to go with gaming, you can take physical money and put it into the internet and buy things on Fortnite or whatever. But you can't do that with spiritual things. You can't do that spiritually. But what you do with that money, what you do with what God's blessed us with, what we don't do with our resources, can be converted into good deeds, can be converted into things that glorify God. And that, my friends, can be a benefit to us spiritually. And that's the focus of a lot of what we've seen in Ecclesiastes. It is not that money is wrong. It is not wrong to have money. It is wrong when that's the focus of our heart. And that's all we're dealing with. And we're going to talk more about that in chapter 6. Any questions or comments as we wrap things up tonight? All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. Y'all have a good rest of your week.